I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. When someone approaches you to donate to a nonprofit, how many of you want to know how much of that money goes to salaries and fundraising and how much goes to actual program services? And if you're like most people, that question probably figures into your decision. Well, the Wagner School of Public Service at NYU found that only 17% of those surveyed feel that charities do a very good job running programs and services, and 70% believe charities waste a great deal or a fair amount of money. And just 10% thought charities did a very good job of spending money wisely. Another survey from Ellison Research found 62% believe that the typical nonprofit spends more than what is reasonable on overhead expenses such as fundraising and administration. So I myself have factored that question, how much is spent on overhead, into my charitable giving. But is it a valid or wise way to make such decisions? According to today's guest, Dan Pallotta, while it may be helpful, much more important is how well they serve their mission, how good a job they're doing solving the problems that you care about. In his earlier book on charitable, Pallotta, who has a record of helping to raise hundreds of millions of dollars for causes, made the case that the way we think about nonprofits and the rules we set for them make it harder for them to succeed on a truly significant scale. Too many nonprofits, he says, are rewarded for how little they spend, not for what they get done. Instead of equating frugality with morality, he asks us to start rewarding charities for big goals and big accomplishments, even if it takes big expenses. Where other folks suggest ways to optimize performance inside the existing paradigm, Uncharitable, his earlier book, suggests that the paradigm itself is the problem and calls into question our fundamental beliefs about charity. Now, with a new book, Charity Case, How the Nonprofit Community Can Stand Up for Itself and Really Change the World, and in a recent very popular TED Talk, he says, my goal is to fundamentally transform the way the public thinks about charity within 10 years. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. At age 21, Dan Pallotta organized 38 of his Harvard classmates to bicycle 4,200 miles across America with him to fight world hunger. He launched Pallotta Teamworks, a for-profit social enterprise that created the AIDS Rides and the Breast Cancer 3 Days, and raised $582 million in 8 years. He's the president of Advertising for Humanity and the author, as I said, of Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofit Undermine Their Potential, and his latest Charity Case, How the Nonprofit Community Can Stand Up for Itself and Really Change the World. Welcome again, Dan Pallotta, to Free Forum.
Well, thanks for having me, Terrence. I love the purpose of your show and your own mission.
Very good. Thank you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work. So I just did a quick bio. But could you tell us in your own words a bit about your personal path to the work that you do today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, so people get a feel for who you are.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you mentioned the cross-country bike ride that I organized. You know, when I was a young kid, I wanted to be a goalie in the NHL, and then I wanted to be the next Bruce Springsteen, and ultimately I decided I wanted to, you know, do something great, and that probably that my skills were better suited to organize people. And I think it was in college when I first started to learn about the massive number of people dying of hunger and hunger-related disease, you know, 20 million people dying every year, most of them kids, most of them dying of diarrhea and diphtheria. And I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood playing hockey, and these statistics were just shocking to me. And it was around the time that Jimmy Carter created his Commission on World Hunger and Werner Erhard started the Hunger Project. And, you know, and I grew up when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, and we dreamed of doing things like going to the moon, impossible things. And I felt, you know, around the age of 19, why aren't we doing something impossible with respect to hunger? Why are we all sitting around acting like this is no big deal? You know, why aren't we doing the most we can possibly do? And that led to this cross-country bike ride, which was, you know, at the age of 20, for me, was the most I could do. It was a big, frightening, terrifying, really, deal to recruit 38 kids to fly to Seattle and then have us all ride our bikes safely across America for 9.5 weeks. And then, you know, I happen to be gay, and I moved to Los Angeles in the mid-'80s, and you know, the AIDS epidemic was at its height, and I was losing lots of friends. And you could see that it's the same feeling that I had in college, that people were losing their lovers and their brothers and their sons and their friends, and there was nothing big you could do about it. You could go stick a red ribbon on your jacket. You could go to the, you know, AIDS Project Los Angeles gala chicken dinner for $500. That was so incongruous with what you were feeling, and people really needed to go to war in their own way, and that's where we started with California AIDS Ride, which was this 7-day, 600-mile grueling bike ride from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and we did not market it to cyclists. You know, we were not looking for the Lance Armstrongs of the world. We were looking for the 69-year-old mother who had lost her son to AIDS, who was petrified of riding her bike from San Francisco to L.A., and who wanted to do something extraordinary in the name of her lost son. And, you know, and that's what gave rise to the incredible success of those events, and really the creation of an industry was asking people to do the most they can do. I think we minimize people. I think people are hungry to measure the fullness of their potential. They don't want to be asked to do the minimum. You know, they're here one time for all they know it in this life, and they want to do something great, but they just need to be asked, and it needs to be presented to them.
Just so people know, when those people volunteer to ride their bike, or there were also the breast cancer hikes and so on, the notion is, one, they're doing something that stretches them, but that doesn't necessarily help the cause unless they're also raising money. So the way they raise money doing that is?
They would go out and ask their friends to pledge them. Now, what we did was new and different, which is what led to the creation of this as an industry, is we had minimum donation requirements. So if you were going to go on the AIDS ride, you had to raise a minimum of $2,000. If you were going to walk for 60 miles in the breast cancer 3-day walk, you had to raise, at the time, I think it was a minimum of $1,200 or $1,500. And that hadn't been done before. Before, these thon events welcomed people with open arms, no matter how much or how little they had raised. Imagine if American Airlines did that. You know, sure, whatever you got, we'll fly you to San Francisco. It just wasn't a very powerful business model. And so we changed that with great success. But I want to raise an interesting point. You said, obviously, that the good has to do with the money they raise. In a lot of cases, you had people doing the AIDS rides who were HIV positive, huge numbers of breast cancer survivors doing the breast cancer 3 days. And this was a life-affirming, positive, uplifting experience for them. In a lot of ways, you could say that the event in and of itself had a serious charitable purpose, certainly for those people, and you know, and raised awareness on a meteoric scale for others who participated in it.
It's funny. I didn't mean to minimize what they did. I thought I said that in the preface to that. But what you're doing there also is you're building community. You're building awareness. Everyone knows they're not alone. They're testing themselves in a way that they've all been tested emotionally up to that point. Now they're testing themselves physically. So yeah. I get that. Let me tell people, by the way, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Dan Pallotta about his new book, Charity Case, How the Nonprofit Community Can Stand Up for Itself and Really Change the World. To learn more, you can go to Dan Pallotta. That's P-A-L-L-O-T-T-A, danpallotta.com, or advertisingforhumanity.com. Now, obviously, there's another turning point, if you will. And when I teach storytelling, I will tell people that if you do something and you go A, B, C, knock off point A, point B, point C, and you achieve what you set out to achieve, that's a great accomplishment. But it's not necessarily a great story, because what we like in our stories is obstacles and barriers and setbacks and the hero or the protagonist having to overcome these things. So what happened that led actually not to more of the same, but to the thinking that goes into these books?
We did the AIDS rides and the breast cancer 3 days for about 9 years, and in the ninth year we also did a big event for suicide prevention. As you said, we raised all these hundreds of millions of dollars. We had 400 full-time employees in 16 U.S. offices. 2002 was our most successful year ever. We netted that year alone, after all expenses, $81 million, and then we went out of business very suddenly, very traumatically. on one day, August 3rd, 2002, during our most successful year. And the short story is we were being crucified in the media for investing 40% of the gross in the recruitment of riders and walkers and in impeccable customer service. And there is no accounting terminology for that kind of investment in the future and in quality and in growth other than this demonic label of overhead. So all that great stuff gets called overhead, simplified, dumbed down to overhead. So on one day, we laid off all 350 of our great employees because they were labeled overhead. And our sponsor on the Breast Cancer 3 Days decided to go try the events on their own. They wanted to distance themselves from us and our reputation as this high overhead company. Well, what happened was their overhead went up and their net income for breast cancer grants went down by 84%. Or $60 million in 1 year. It went from $70 million with us down to about $10 million on their own net after all expenses. And this is why I say that this is what happens when we confuse frugality with morality. You know, we've been taught that the bake sale with 5% overhead is morally superior to the professional fundraising enterprise with 40% overhead, but we're missing the most important piece of information. You know, these things are always shown as pie charts, right?
Right.
One pie chart with 5% overhead and the other pie chart with 40% overhead, and you think, oh, wow, well, I'm going to give to the one with the 5% overhead. The trouble is they always show those pies as the same size.
Oh, right,
that's
exactly.
That's the piece of information you're missing. What is the actual size of those pies? What if the bake sale is tiny? What if the bake sale only netted $71? Who cares if its overhead was 5%? And the professional fundraising enterprise netted $71 million because they put 40% into growth. That's actually a graph of that famous statement, it takes money to make money. So we're teaching the public all the wrong things. We're dealing with these social problems that are huge in scale, and so we need organizations that are huge, right? We need organizations that are raising a lot of revenue. But so long as we tell them you can't spend any money on that fundraising sliver, they can't grow because it takes money to make money. So anyway, that's my... That's chapter two.
And just so people know,
hero's journey. There.
Right, exactly. And just so people know that the company you had that was running, organizing, and running these events was a for-profit company.
Yeah, it was a for-profit company, and we charged a fixed production fee. We didn't do a percentage or a commission or take something off the top. You know, we just charged X dollars. We'll produce this event for you, no matter how much or how little it raises. Now, if you do a hindsight calculation, that turned out to be very small. It turned out to be 4.01% of the gross that we were
raising. Because you didn't know how successful you could be.
No.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, a lot of people think, oh, you were a for-profit company doing charity events, so you took in all this money. No, that's not the case. 100% of the money, 100% of the money went to the charities right at the outset. And then they paid us our fee out of that money, and they reimbursed us for expenses. So we would send them an invoice, they would approve the invoice, and they would reimburse us. So we never touched the donations. And I think that was the thing that people didn't really understand.
Yeah, they thought it went through you rather than through them. Let me ask you a couple of questions, because when we get into the meat of these books and so on, we're going to leave this topic. But in terms of this notion of for-profits working with nonprofits and so on, what is that field like? In other words, what makes the headlines is not just when something is expensive, but when something is corrupt. You know, in other words, that's what people read about, is when someone who was either within the nonprofit side or the for-profit side working with nonprofits does something illegal, embezzles, that sort of thing. What is sort of the status of that piece of the industry?
See, here's the fascinating thing. When people hear a for-profit company raising money for a nonprofit company, it gives them pause.
That's right.
They feel right about it. And a lot of people think, well, maybe that's something new, and if it's something new, I don't much like it. But here's the thing. There has been for-profit, non-profit interaction since the beginning of the sector. You go into any charity, they bought their lamps at IKEA.
Of course.
Which is a for-profit institution. They bought their computers at the Apple store. They're buying their phone service from AT&T. Perini Construction built their building. There's all of this for-profit, non-profit interaction going on. It's when an entrepreneur who has a name and puts his name on that company does these high-profile events that it all of a sudden puts that in the spotlight in a big way, and something that had never dawned on people all of a sudden becomes a lightning rod. So I wasn't doing anything remotely new. In fact, what was really interesting, here's what was really interesting. We were being crucified in the media for spending money on media, right?
Right.
We're being crucified in the media for being a for-profit company. But guess what we're doing? We're paying the New York Times $75,000 for a full-page ad about the AIDS ride, and that's a for-profit institution. We spent more on media. On a given event, we would spend $500,000 on media, and our fee might be $370,000. So every event we created, the media made more money on it than we did as the creators of it and the producers of it. Fascinating irony.
Yeah. And you used
to... and then those papers are trying to paint us as some kind of demon.
Right. In other words, if they want it, why didn't they give you free advertising if that's
exactly
the way the world's supposed to work?
And when you bring that up with the investigative reporter, they get all holier than thou. Oh, well, I'm just a reporter. I don't deal with the business side of things. Yeah, but the business side of things pays your salary.
Yeah. And you also did things like ads on the sides of buses and those sorts of things?
Yeah. You know, you asked about my early days. For some reason, when I was 6 and 7, I was fascinated with marketing, and I used to draw the 7-Up logo and the Necco logo and the Coca-Cola logo. I still have these old drawings, and it's like, what is that, you know?
Yeah.
And when I came into the nonprofit sector, my immediate feeling was, why aren't they doing things in the way Coca-Cola is doing them? Why don't they have beautiful ads and beautiful color materials? Why can't we promote the great needs of these starving children with the same kind of sophistication that BMW promotes the sale of their cars? So from the get-go, when we launched the AIDS Rise, yeah, I wanted full-page ads in the LA Times, and I wanted television ads and primetime morning radio ads, and that's what drove the success of them. That's how we raised $582 million. If we had put up posters in the dry cleaners the way most charities are expected, and only do that, we might have had 72 people ride, and we would have raised, $90,000.
Right. I mean, one of the things that the nonprofit world has that the corporate world envies, I'm sure, is these fabulous stories, is these fabulous things that corporations, they do everything they can to try to touch your heart in a way that then triggers your pocketbook.
Yeah.
Nonprofits and causes start out with a huge advantage.
They do, and then they lose that advantage because we don't want them to spend any money telling their stories. We don't like it when we get the brochure from them in the mail, and God forbid some charity was to spend $3 million on a 30-second Super Bowl commercial. They would just be vilified.
Exactly.
But people don't understand. You know, it's kind of economics 101. I majored in economics in college that, the for-profit sector first builds the product, like John Kenneth Galbraith said, and then through the massive engines of advertising, it builds the market for that product. You know, you didn't know you needed an iPad, and then all of a sudden Apple started telling you needed an iPad and you wanted an iPad. Well, we don't allow charities to do that, and as a result, charitable giving in the United States has remained stuck at 2% of GDP for 40 years. And that means that in 4 decades, the nonprofit sector has not been able to take an iota of market share away from the for-profit sector. How could it if you don't allow it to market? If you allow Princess Cruises and Disney and all the big movies and concerts and everything else to advertise and be in your face constantly, but you tell charities, we don't want you to tell us your story, you're going to have a lot fewer donations. You know, the thing I like to say to the layperson who doesn't have time to understand all of the economics of this is a simple question. Do you want to be the only donor? because if you don't let your favorite charity spend money on fundraising, a lot of it, they can't find other donors. So if you want them to spend next to nothing on fundraising, you had better be prepared to be the only donor. Now, I don't think that's what you want. Do you really want to be the only donor?
I'm Terrence McNally, and that other voice is Dan Pallotta. And we're talking about his new book, Charity Case, How the Nonprofit Community Can Stand Up for Itself and Really Change the World. And you can learn more at danpallotta.com, P-A-L-L-O-T-T-A, or advertisingforhumanity.com. It seems to me that one nonprofit area that plays with this a little differently might be religion. In other words, in terms of how the mega churches or some of those outfits do with television and with the events they put on and the productions they put on, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, those are expensive forms of marketing, and wouldn't you know it, look at how those churches have grown.
Exactly.
It's just a case in point, you know. It's sophisticated, professional fundraising enterprises. You know what? One of the organizations that was doing this early on and continues to was World Vision, you know, where you
Yes.
used to see the sponsor a child. And I still do. I mean, I think I've sponsored a child for something like 20 years at $24 a month or something through them. And they did enormous amounts of television advertising, and they're like a $3 billion organization now.
They saw their great story. They saw their great characters. They saw what would work, and they weren't afraid, for whatever reason, to do it in a very professional and slick way.
Right, exactly. I think also for your listeners, Terrence, that there's this one aspect that I just brought up about do you want to be the only donor, which is, you know, an approach to someone's rationale. The other issue is I think you donate because you want the problem solved. I don't think you donate because you want low overhead. We as a generation don't want our tombstone to read, "We kept charity overhead low."
Right.
We want it to read that we changed the world. What you don't understand as a donor is that if you really want to solve these problems, and these problems are huge, and the charities are tiny, then the only way to solve the problem is for the charities to start to get as huge as the problem. And in order to do that, they're going to have to raise a lot more money, and they're going to have to raise it from a lot more people. They're going to have to make the same kind of investment in growth and research and development of how to grow as the big consumer brands do. So as a donor who really wants the problem to be solved, you should really be looking for the organizations that have big dreams. And actually, the other thing that you should be happy about is if an organization is investing your dollar in fundraising, they're multiplying your dollar. That doesn't happen when you give it to a bowl of soup. You say, "I want my money to go directly to the bowl of soup." Okay, you just donated $5 and you bought two bowls of soup. That's great. If you had said, "I want the $5 to go to the fundraiser," the fundraiser might have been able to turn that into $20, and you could have gotten eight bowls of soup. And they might have found other donors as well, you know. So we've created this new entity called the Charity Defense Council that will start to educate the public about these things. And one of the ads will show a, you know, five-year-old, six-year-old girl who's holding a lemonade stand for the poor. And at the end of the commercial, she says, "I want all of this money to go to fundraising and administration because I want this organization to grow, you know, to help the people see the logic of a child, the fascinating,
Yeah. Let me just tell people, by the way, another thing about the nonprofit world is that very often, I'm going to try to do this, and you'll help me out when I finish putting it out here. Very often, foundations for whom nonprofits depend for a lot of their funds and private donors and so on want only, as you said, to fund the program, to only fund the bowl of soup. And it turns out that that nonprofit, if you don't fund its training of new employees, its development of employees, its marketing, its fundraising, all of those other pieces, then you actually – the dollars you give it to run its programs almost put it behind the eight ball, because if a program grows, you need more staff and better trained staff. You need better fundraising. You need these things. And this idea of what's called administration or overhead, those sorts of things that people think is a black hole, is actually, you would never run, I mean, this goes back to something you would say many times, you would never run a business that way.
Yeah, I like to use the simple example of two soup kitchens, you know, A and B, and A tells you 95 cents of your donation goes to the cause, and B tells you 70 cents goes to the cause. Well, we've all been trained, this is a no-brainer, I'm going to give to soup kitchen A. But what if you actually went and visited the soup kitchens, and you found that soup kitchen A was serving rancid soup in a dilapidated facility, and they had a really unfriendly staff? And soup kitchen B, because they invested 30% in their overhead, had a well-trained staff that was super friendly. They were serving hearty, nutritious soup in a state-of-the-art facility. They were open 24 hours a day, and they did case management. Now it's clear, geez, I should have given to soup kitchen B. They're clearly the better provider of social services. The question, the simple, dumbed-down, narrow question, what percentage of my donation went to the cause, would have betrayed you completely in terms of trying to make the right decision about which organization to give to. So we have to start asking questions about how good is the organization at what they actually do, how impactful are they, and really, what are their dreams? Do they have a dream that inspires me? Are they dead serious about it? Are they making progress toward it? And how do they know? Those are the important questions. You know, some people like to say, well, look, this overhead question is, we should ask it even though it's imperfect because it's the only question we have. Well, that's like taking your kid's temperature with a broken thermometer because it's the only thermometer you have in the house. Right? I mean, better not to take the kid's temperature than be in mystery about whether he or she is sick rather than to take it with a broken thermometer and be convinced that she's well when she's actually dying.
Right. And you're saying that overhead, that merely looking at overhead without looking at the delivery and even the aspirations of the organization is like a broken thermometer. Let me tell you, there's a format that I sort of use in thinking about a show like this, and it's broke, let's fix it. And it's three questions, basically. How is X broken? How did it get broken? And how do we fix it? Okay, so we're talking about charitable policies, the policies toward charity in the United States. We've been talking about how they're broken. I want to ask you a little bit of history of how, because you've thought about this, how they got broken, why we hold some of these misbegotten ideas we hold, and then most of the second half will be on how we fix them. But before I do that, let me tell people again, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Dan Pallotta about his new book, Charity Case, How the Nonprofit Community Can Stand Up for Itself and Really Change the World. To learn more, go to Dan Pallotta, P-A-L-L-O-T-T-A, danpallotta.com or advertisingforhumanity.com. Okay, a bit of this history. How did these ideas and policies get broken?
Well, I did a lot of research on it for my first book. I had a lot of research on the early Puritan settlers to New England because I grew up in New England, and this idea that we should deprive charities of any resources felt really, the intense frugality of it felt really Puritan to me. And it was fascinating. I spent 6 months reading books on the early Puritan settlers to New England, and the long and short of it was they came to America for religious reasons in the 1630s. But they also came here because they wanted to make money. They make a lot of money. They were very aggressive capitalists, and they were accused of extreme forms of profit-making tendencies compared to the other colonists. But at the same time, they were Calvinists. So they were taught literally to hate themselves. They were taught that self-interest was a raging sea that was a sure path to eternal damnation. So this created a real problem for these people. They've come all the way across the Atlantic to make all this money, and making this money will get you sent directly to hell. You know, an incredible psychological tension. And then this further tension that wealth was a sign that you were right with God, but wealth for yourself was an evil thing. So one historian said that you had to be a mental contortionist to understand the difference. So charity became their answer. It became this economic sanctuary where they could do penance for their profit-making tendencies at 5 cents on the dollar, you know, give 5 or 10 cents to charity. Get
well. If we're talking about tithing, it would be 10 cents on the dollar, right?
Yeah. 10 cents on the dollar. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, of course, how then could you make money in charity if charity was your penance for making money? They created these two economic worlds where there was really only ever one. And the needy and all those who wanted to help them, who were women mostly, by the way, got this religion whereby everything that worked in the market was banished, and the carpenters and the merchants and the farmers, they all got free market practice. And in 400 years, nothing has intervened to say that's illogical, that's irrational, and it's unjust. Why would you have one set of rules for putting a computer on everybody's desk and another set of rules for helping everybody who needs a bowl of food? So it really came from there, and then, you know, the Protestant missionary tradition carried it on, and that's why a lot of this thinking has been anchored in the institutional funding community, you know, with foundations. But pretty much, you know, wherever there was original sin,
right,
and the self was an evil thing, and the self had to be negated, charity became this selfless way of ensuring your place in heaven or ensuring that you were right with God, which is why we are very religious about these things. We are not rational. There is no difference of opinion between Nancy Pelosi and Dick Cheney on how charities ought to operate. You know, they're in locked step that overhead should be low and CEOs should not be paid very much. But what if a CEO who's paid more money can, you know, increase the money for the organization by a factor of 10? No. Shouldn't do it. So there's no rationality. It's all this religious emotion because these things are cardinal sins. So there's no logic to it. And that's I believe, where a lot of the thinking came from. You know, when you do the history on
okay.
it, the smoking guns.
So what we've done there is we've divided in our culture, and it goes back because our culture really does begin from those settlers' culture and then infuses the culture from there with this notion that there is, you know, I mean, I can remember it was, you know, you can't serve God and mammon, you know, this that business is one thing and charity is another. What's your perspective on – I just did a recent show on social entrepreneurs, social enterprises, all of the intermingling that's going on now with B Corps and these sorts of things where business has a social purpose and might business sacrifice some of its profits to a social purpose. What's your kind of perspective on what's happening in that realm? Is that akin to what you're talking about?
I think what's happening in that realm is great, but – I don't think that the general public is ready yet for people to make a lot of money in charity. You know, I think we can have all the fancy words we want for it, social entrepreneurship, social enterprise. Once, you know, CNN spotlight team decides to say, like they did with the Boys and Girls Clubs a year and a half ago, the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club is making almost $1 million immediately, burn her at the stake. You know, she ended up resigning. So I think in the thought leadership circles, we like to think we're being more progressive about this, and perhaps we are, but even at that level, people have a hard time saying someone should be able to get rich in charity if they produce commensurate value.
I'm asking another question, actually, Dan.
Oh, okay.
In addition to that question, it's like, so are the barriers breaking down? Are we beginning to think that maybe business should do more good and charity? I mean, you get what I'm saying. It's not just about whether you can pay your CEO of your charity a lot of money. Is this this new way of looking at things?
I mean, I think the stuff that's going on the business end is good. I think business is always going to move the great mass of humanity forward. You know, whether it's the refrigerated boxcar or the automobile or the canning of food, you know, it's been in the for-profit sector that we've made the great, great advances so that we're not living in caves. But the for-profit sector is always going to leave 5 or 7 or 10% behind. And there, you're never going to be able to monetize those issues. So you're always going to have the need for philanthropy, and philanthropy is the market for love. So while B corporations are great, they address the for-profit sector, you know, being kinder to employees, the L3C corporation.
Or kinder to the environment. In other words, one of the things you're saying is that while business has made great strides that have provided true progress, the side effects, the consequences, whether it's climate change or poverty-ridden parts of town and so on, and those sorts of things, are also in that bag. And so these social enterprises.
I actually don't necessarily believe that business creates poverty. You know, but for business, we would all be poor.
No. What I was saying was that the poverty areas might be where the dirtiest industries happen, and those sorts of things. That those kinds of divisions happen as a consequence of someone making profit by perhaps ultimately supplying a good, but that there are some side effects and consequences. And what I think that the social enterprises are attempting to do, or the conscious capitalism attempting to do, is to mitigate some of that. But the point you make is that there's still going to be, as you say, 10% that just doesn't show up on their balance sheet.
Yeah, I mean, look at this, something that's probably pretty removed from business, one could say, violence against women, right? Okay, how are you going to monetize that? How is a social business going to monetize the prevention of violence against women, or the charity where I sit on the board for the developmentally disabled who want companionship and laughter and love? How do you monetize that? Well, that's where philanthropy comes in. And while B Corps and L3Cs and these other things are doing great things, really great things, to address business becoming more passionate, you are always going to have this need for the nonprofit sector to help society's most disadvantaged or unlucky. And we have a tremendous injustice toward that sector. And we had better start to address the injustice over there. B corporations and everything, that's great. But the real problem is on this side of the line. You know?
Yeah, some things will still fall through that crack. Even if you move it, some things will fall through that crack. And philanthropy will always be needed.
Breast cancer won't get cured and Alzheimer's won't get cured and people will continue to commit suicide at high rates. That's where the nonprofit sector comes in. Massive social issues and social problems, and you've got a dysfunctional operating system for that part of society. Well, you're never going to solve these problems. So where we ought to start focusing our thinking is on how we make that functional.
Yeah. So now, when it comes time to shifting into the solutions, is the solution, how important a leverage point in that solution is the way the public perceives and thinks about these things?
Huge. That is a huge lever. That's a great point, Terrence. The public gives, you know, most of the $300 billion that's donated to charity in America every year. 75% of that comes from individuals. So that's a huge pressure point. If 75% of that $300 billion wants overhead to be low, then you bet your bottom charities are going to try to keep their overhead low. And then that public sentiment, you know, the people who work at foundations are part of the general public, so that sentiment infects their thinking. Public policymakers, they react pretty quickly and pretty fundamentally to the way the public feels about things. So even though a state legislator or a congressman might know that the better public policy is to let these organizations spend money to raise money, if their constituents want a witch hunt for a CEO who was paid what they think is too much at a charity, then that witch hunt's going to happen. So the general public is a huge lever, and that's where I think we need to focus on changing the way the public thinks about these things. The public doesn't want to think wrongly about these things, but nobody's ever taken them the time to teach them the right way to think about these things.
And so you, in Charity Case, put forward a few ideas. One is a Charity Defense Council. One is a charity advertising in a big way, like advertising not just about the specific cause, but about the whole arena of charity and nonprofits, and a National Civil Rights Act for charity and social enterprise. So first, the Charity Defense Council. What is that? How would it work?
It's a national leadership organization that will advocate for the sector, and it will do five things. It will perform five basic functions of grassroots organizing that every other community has and the nonprofit sector doesn't. And those five things are, number one, an anti-defamation league for the sector. Number two, a legal defense fund for the sector. Number three, as you said, paid public advertising about these issues direct to the public. Number four, organize the sector so that we can touch a button and have 300,000 nonprofit employees email their senator about an ill-conceived piece of legislation. And number five, a National Civil Rights Act for charity and social enterprise. Every other community, you know, the gay and lesbian community, the Jewish community has an anti-defamation mechanism. The nonprofit sector doesn't. MALDEF and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and Lambda Legal for the gay and lesbian community. Nonprofit sector has no well-funded legal defense fund. We've never taken out a full-page ad in the New York Times or anywhere else to try and educate the public about overhead. Not once, not once. So no wonder the public thinks what they think. We've never tried to change their minds. It's not the public's fault. So that's what the Charity Defense Council will do. There's that statistic that you brought up, that 70% of respondents in the survey believe that charities waste a great deal or a fair amount of money. 10 years from now, I want 70% of respondents to think the opposite.
Okay. That's Dan Pallotta. We're talking about the ideas in his book, Charity Case, how the nonprofit community can stand up for itself and really change the world. And you can learn more at danpallotta.com, P-A-L-L-O-T-T-A, or advertisingforhumanity.com. Do the people in the sector... You've said that they sort of are members of the public as well. How many of them sort of know that this doesn't work but are afraid to say it because of – I mean, just this, obviously you're just guessing or estimating, but afraid to say it because it hasn't been made legitimate or okay?
The sector's absolutely complicit in this. They, you know, put the seals of approval of the watchdogs on their website. You know, one of the ways you get that seal of approval is by having low overhead. So when you put that on the homepage of your website, you're broadcasting to the public that overhead is the most critical thing. And, you know, and the CEOs of these nonprofit organizations know that that's not the case, you know, but maybe it's their board that wants them to put it on there. In a lot of cases, even people in the sector haven't thought these things through, you know. They grew up on the same religion, and I'll do a lot of conferences. I'll speak at a lot of conferences where you have exclusively nonprofit employees, and they'll come up to me afterwards and say, some of them will say, I'm glad somebody's finally said it, but a lot of them will say, I never thought about it in this way, and you've completely changed the way I think about it. Especially if you're on the program side. If you work for a major homelessness charity in Los Angeles, say, you know, you work for St. Joseph's Center and you're serving soup to the poor, you've never thought much about these things. Whereas if you work on the fundraising side of the organization, you've probably thought a lot about these things because you don't have the resources that you really need to raise enough money for the program to expand. So you've got a lot of people on the program side of charities and a lot of foundations that work pretty exclusively on the program side of things who've not thought much about these things because they've never had to in their particular roles.
Okay. Tell us a bit, just for listeners' sake, about the watchdogs or ratings organizations. In other words, and I'm going to name a few. There's Charity Navigator, Better Business Bureau, Charity Watch, GuideStar, Great Nonprofits. What do they do, and are any of them able to give you the kinds of guidance that leads in the direction you're pointing to or not?
The United States needs a national, what I call iTunes for charity, where any donor can go on any charity, any of the 1.2, 3, 4, 5 million charities in the United States, and get objectively gathered, up-to-date information, not only on the organization's finances, but on their programs and on their stories. We lack that utterly and completely right now. That's an apparatus that would cost several billion dollars, you know, a pittance compared to the $300 billion we give away to charity, but several billion dollars. And the amount of money that these well-meaning watchdogs have right now is, you know, at best $1 or $2 million each. So you've got, you know, Charity Navigator, which has, I think, a $1.3 million budget. That's it. They have 12 or 13 full-time staff. They look at 7,500 charities, this in a country where there are 1.5 million nonprofit organizations, and they don't do program evaluation. Why? Because that's wildly expensive. You couldn't do program evaluation on more than 20 charities with a $1.1 million budget. The Better Business Bureau is also about a $1.1, $1.2 million organization with, you know, 10 to 15 staff. Charity Watch is smaller. I think they're half.
Wait, did you say the Better Business Bureau in the $1 million range?
Alliance. The Better Business Bureau Wise Giving Alliance.
Oh, that piece of the Better Business Bureau. Got it.
That piece of it, yeah.
So as you're saying, I mean, they have the names. Tiny. They sort of are saying, raising their hand and saying, we're doing this work, but their ability to do it in any meaningful way is impossible given their resources.
Yeah, you know why? Because they can't spend any money on overhead.
That's right. No, I understand.
Which is really ironic. You
yeah.
Know? Now, you've got GuideStar, right? Which, now, GuideStar has a database, a massive database of, I don't know, many, many hundreds of thousands of charities, but it's primarily, well, it's all financial information. So they don't do any kind of rating. They just present you with the financial information that they get, mostly, as I understand it, from tax information. Great nonprofits is wonderful. They're sort of like a Yelp rating system,
mm-hmm.
as I understand it. You know, one of the issues that could happen with that kind of a model is a charity that isn't very effective at programs, but has a lot of constituents could say, hey, go on to this site and like us, and you'll get lots of likes without a very sophisticated look at the program side of things.
As you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, the whole thing that you're saying about how they should have more money to market, what could happen is a charity that isn't doing that well at accomplishing its goals could do a great job at marketing. I mean,
absolutely.
Obviously, this happens in the business world. This can also happen in the nonprofit world. So that would not be, that would not assure us that the marketing would be valid.
Absolutely. And that's why the donor has to be more sophisticated. And instead of asking about simple things like overhead, I tell people, look, put the same kind of effort into deciding what charity you're going to contribute to that you put into deciding which flat screen television you're going to buy or which washer and dryer you're going to buy or which candidate you're going to vote
mm-hmm,
for
mm-hmm.
for assembly. You take a lot of time to make decisions in your life. Think of yourself as a philanthropist. I don't care if you only give $100 to charity a year because that's what you can afford. That's still philanthropy, love of humanity. And partner, you know, you'll always be asked to give to this disaster or that disaster, and you'll do that. But think about, in the larger context, what cause is really important to you and what impact would you like to have on it in your life? And then do some research on a charity that you can partner with for life or for a decade, and go call the organization. Ask for a meeting with the development director. That's why the development director is there. Ask them to take you for a tour of the facility or explain what they do, explain how they measure what they do. You know, have a real face-to-face interaction. Take some time to do that and check up on them every year, or they'll probably check up on you every year.
One of the things you're suggesting is even if you aren't a big donor, a major donor, this isn't an identity you have, that still, rather than spraying your money around to anything that you care about, to focus.
Yeah, and you know, you can spray money around as well, but you really ought to decide what impact you want to make in your life and do proper research on the organization. You know, ultimately, only the public can protect against the low-impact organization being well-funded. You know, ultimately, we have to take personal responsibility for what we do. We're addicted to simplicity in this culture. And, you know, I'm telling people, don't ask about overhead, don't ask about overhead. There's also a risk there that people will start now asking very simplistically about effectiveness, and charities will start working on the problems that are easiest to show effectiveness on, because that's where all the money. So the real demon here is our addiction to simplicity.
Right.
It's a new age, and you read The Power of Now and Marianne Williamson, and they tell us to live in the moment. Well, let's practice that a little bit. Let's live in the moment, and let's experience the beauty of generosity, and let's make a process out of it. Take your whole family, your children, to the charity and learn about it together. You know, enrich your life in that way. It'll be more fun than going to the mall. You know, it'll be as much fun as going on a hike.
I say to people that nothing a charity can do usually will impact potential donors or donors as much as a site visit to actually go and see what they're doing on the ground. And that ends up, as you say, being a moving experience that, that transcends them all. Let me ask you a bigger question about the U.S. model. I'm going to read a quote of you and then ask a question. You say big government is the enemy of the full potential of the humanitarian sector. The more the state insists on providing services, the less inclined private individuals are to fund similar services with charitable contributions. Makes sense. Charitable giving is much less, this is still quoting you, as a percentage of GDP in Italy, Spain, Greece, and other Western European countries with a wide array of government-provided social services. As a percentage of GDP, charitable giving in the United States is about double that of its closest competitor, the UK. Funds given to charity in the US are not nearly enough to solve our social problems. We must get charitable giving to a substantially higher percentage of GDP in order for that to happen. Now, it seems to me there's another alternative, which is transforming other entities, and I've sort of asked about this a little bit before, government and business, to support the social contract. How is our model better than the model of Germany, for example, with worker participation in corporate boards, worker participation in corporate decision-making, healthcare, higher education and training, family leave, free or very reasonable for everyone? They're taken seriously. They're offered for free or affordably to the population. Do you find our model better, or do you merely say it's the one we got to work with?
Well, I think there are great models all over the world, and the German example that you bring up is a wonderful model. But, you know, it's isolated to issues of income inequality, and we forget that there's a spectrum of issues that goes way beyond income equality. There are issues like violence against women. There are issues like the need for a cure for epilepsy and for breast cancer, high rates of suicide, and they haven't cured breast cancer in Germany.
Right.
Either, you know, and so there's a whole set of issues that, you know, may not be vulnerable to that type of model. And again, I think that's where the nonprofit sector comes in and private ingenuity. You know, I'm just a big fan of private ingenuity, and I think people in the nonprofit sector are as well. They believe in their organizations and they believe in the innovation of their approaches, but they're starved for resources. So I think that we would be smart to let individuals and collectives of individuals that run these organizations really fly and really soar and show us their capability of solving problems. Government hasn't solved these problems yet, and it's had a lot of resources, you know.
Right. Let me see if you and I are on the same page here then. While it would be better, I think, that education and healthcare and family leave and training and those sorts of things were more widely spread, more widely available, more affordable or free, that would still not solve, as you say. And while Germany is doing a great job on, let's say, renewable energy, that's not the same thing as, you say, people with disabilities, violence toward women, violence toward children, that there are certain things that will fall through those cracks even of a social safety net, and that so wherever we are in whatever model you're operating with, a thriving, healthy charitable sector is a necessity for a thriving, healthy society.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a total imbalance that the nonprofit sector is 2% of GDP when it's dealing with the, you know, the giving is that when it's dealing with the most pressing problems. We need more of a balance there too. And yeah, and in terms of your first point about healthcare and education, I'm all for what's the most efficient answer. You know, I grew up, I went to public schools and got into an Ivy League school in an age when public schools were terrific and not many people thought of sending their kids elsewhere. And I wish to God we could somehow return to that.
Okay,
you know?
I've got to end it there. So again, the book is Charity Case, How the Nonprofit Community Can Stand Up for Itself and Really Change the World. The websites are danpallotta.com, PALLOTTA.com, or advertisinforhumanity.com. Thank you, Dan Pallotta, and keep up the good work.
Terrence, thank you. You always have the most interesting conversations. You take the time to read the books. I love talking to you.
Great. Thanks a lot. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at my site. My site is terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, all one word. You can also learn more there. You can find articles, podcasts go back many years. They're readily available 24 hours a week, anytime. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about in two or three articles of background, you can sign up at my site or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y. temcnally@mac.com. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production, and Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.